Welcome to the Redeemer Covenant Church podcast. Thanks for listening. At Redeemer, we are dedicated to following Jesus and connecting people to God's transforming love. If you want to stay connected to all that's happening here, visit rcctulsa.org or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We have been talking for the whole month of January about this idea of renovate and what it means for God's presence to renovate our lives. And when I was thinking this week about what the sermon was, where it was going this week, I thought the best picture I can think of that the image of renovation in my own life is my mom's love of redoing the rooms in her house. In case you're wondering, I asked her permission to share this story. But my parents would typically buy a house that needed a little loving, tender care, you know, needed a little work. And so Dee would start in one room and make it perfect and good and wonderful, and then move to the next room. And you know, by the time we got done, it was about 2 years. I'm probably exaggerating the story a little bit, but she would work on each room. But then when we're done with all the rooms, she'd kind of just step back and start over on the room that was the first room she did in the first place. And early on in our marriage, Gary figured this out and realized that she was open to inspiration. And so we were sitting at dinner one night. I think this is one of the examples. It happened numerous times. But we're sitting at dinner, and Gary looks around in their kitchen. He goes, Dee, you know, you should, like, antique these cabinets. And my dad, like, kicks him under the table and says, Gary, don't give her any ideas. And we all laugh, and it's ha-ha funny. But it's really funny 2 weeks later when I walked in the kitchen, and my dad's antiquing the cabinets. So my mom had this wonderful ability, a master of reimagining what a space could look like. She knew how to build into a home, a place that felt like home. So even a few years ago when they moved to Phoenix for a couple of years, and I would go out and visit them, I would walk into this house that I didn't grow up in, and I would think, this feels like home, because it had Dee Moore's touch on it. And it just felt like a space I could live in and relax in and just be at home. I feel like in this series, this is what we've been trying to do, to reimagine what spiritual space looks like in our lives and what God is trying to do with the spiritual space in us by adjusting our priorities, helping us with different choices that fit the picture he's trying to give us. So redoing the rooms of the house is a wonderful metaphor for God's work in us, because he's constantly at work, and he's constantly working on this space and then coming back and helping us with this space, but never content to leave us the way we are. And so I just want to give you the bottom line right off the bat this morning. He is never finished with us, and he doesn't give up on us. So neither should we. Now, I could just say, okay, I'm done. That's enough. That's what I want you to take this morning. But let's unpack that. Let's decide, what does that look like to not give up? Because there is a God in heaven who loves us, who has not given up. There are renovation stories all through Scripture. And there are some pivotal ones for the people of Israel in the Old Testament. And in those stories, they are beginning to understand what this identity they have is in being the people God chose to tell his story, to live the story he is writing, and then share it with the world. That's their wonderful, unique role in the world. And by the way, as the church of God today, that is our wonderful, unique role too. To live the story he's writing so that others can hear it and we can share it. All this month, we've talked about renovate. I talked about on December 31st, what matters most. Before we do the checklist of what we need to get done in 2018, let's take a step back and let's ask the question, God, what matters most? Bill talked about just entering into the very presence of God and how that changes us and transforms us. Adam talked about our relationships with our family and our friends and the neighbor we don't even know. And then we talked about the peace of God that transcends all of our understanding and our thoughts and all the things that might overrun our emotions and make us lose sight of God's love for us, and letting that peace make a difference for us. So we want to take all those things and put an exclamation point on them this morning. And I want to start with a story of the people of Israel in Exodus. We're going to end up in Exodus 33. If you like to follow along, you can look in the Bible that you brought with you, or if there's one in front of your chair, you can use that. And the scriptures will also be on the screen. But before we jump to Exodus 33, I'm going to give you the background, okay? So the people of Israel have just been rescued by God from centuries of slavery in Egypt. They have had a miraculous escape through the Red Sea, where they crossed on dry land with the water beside them, and God has led them to the base of Mount Sinai. There have been a whole lot of other wonderful interactions and miracles that God has done on the way. Those are just a couple of the highlights. But they get to the base of Mount Sinai, and this is what it says in Exodus 19. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. They took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended upon it in fire. The smoke went up like the smoke of a kiln, and while the whole mountain shook violently, as the blast of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses would speak and God would answer in thunder. Has he ever spoken to you in thunder? There's a storm outside. Jeez. In the thunder. Oh, I think I just heard my name. That would be incredible, wouldn't it? I want to just paint a picture here. I think there are times in our life we encounter someone that we haven't seen for a long, long time, or we're starting a new chapter in the relationship. Maybe we got sideways with each other and we've got to figure a few things out. And have you ever done this? You walk up to somebody and you go, "Hi, my name is Denise McKinney. It's so nice to meet you." And everybody knows each other, right? It's our symbolic way of saying, "Let's start over. Let's try that again." Or, "So glad to see you again, and let's just reintroduce ourselves to each other." I feel like in this story, God is gathering the people of Israel around Mount Sinai, and he's saying, "Hey, my name is the Creator God, Yahweh, and I'm the one who brought you out of Egypt, got you through the Red Sea, and brought you to this place today. And by the way, I'm here. I'm here, present with you for the next chapter." That's a pretty good picture. That's a pretty good restart to a new chapter. And so, after that, he calls Moses up to the mountain, and he's going to give Moses the Ten Commandments, what I like to call the "what matters most" list. So we talked about that in December, but if we just need a written list of what matters most, there's a few of them that he gave already. These are the things that are best for how we live in relationship to God and in relationship to each other. Unfortunately, Moses stays up on the mountain for the "what matters most" Ten Commandment list a little too long for their liking. And so the people of Israel down in the valley are like, "Where is he? Where did he go? Did he die up there? What is taking so long? We have places to go. We have a promised land to get to. Maybe we should figure out a plan B. Is there a plan B? Hey, how about we gather all the jewels and the gold and the ornamentation that we have, and let's create our own God to worship that we can see and that we can tell it what we want or need." I don't know what they were planning to do with a golden calf that doesn't speak and doesn't do any thunder, but they traded the promise that was coming down the mountain very soon, but they had not yet seen, for what was right in front of them at the moment that they could create and take charge of and control. By the time Moses gets down the mountain, it is a crazy, out of control, too much of a bad thing kind of a party happening. It is not a good sight to behold, and God is not pleased. He's incredibly disappointed, deeply grieved that suddenly, after everything, just a few days, just a few weeks of waiting, and they lost sight of what matters most. So we pick up the story in Exodus 33, starting at verse 1. God says to Moses, "Leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt, and go to the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'I will give it to your descendants. I will send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you. Because you are a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you on the way. Ouch! Okay, so you're thinking, maybe I think, wait, don't we talk about God being love and forgiveness? And what is this that he says, if I go with you, I just might wipe you out? Well, let's look at it from how we interact with each other. Maybe that will help us understand the character of God a little better. First of all, I just want to point out that he is sending them on, go on. He's not sending them away. I think that's really important. He's not saying, I'm done with you people. He is saying, I need a break. I need a break. Have you ever needed time out with somebody that you love that's exasperating you? I love you, but I cannot deal with you right now. And really, it's somebody you deeply care about. But usually the people we love the most are the ones that really know how to push our buttons. And so I feel like God is frustrated on this cosmic level. Really? Really? This is after everything we've been through together, and this is where we land. I need a break from you people. I'm not going to send you away, but I might catch up later. The promise has not been revoked. The plan has not changed, except that God is saying, go on. But Moses, being an advocate for the people and a man after God's own heart, is not going to let it stay there either. And you may say, well, can God do that? He's perfect and all-powerful and all-knowing. Can God just do that and say, I need a break from you people? Well, I can't explain all the ins and outs of God's character, because I think that if we try to sum all that up, we will probably fall miserably short in trying to understand the wholeness of him. But he encourages and invites us to try. And I would just say this, that it is perfectly reasonable, I think, for God to be deeply disappointed in people giving up on the promise. But that doesn't mean he gives up on the people. And if he didn't care about them, I don't think that their behavior would matter to him that much. If he didn't care about us, our choices wouldn't matter. He could care less, because he doesn't love us, but he does love us. And so how we live matters to him. C.S. Lewis says, of course God does not consider you hopeless. If he did, he would not be moving you to seek him. Of course he doesn't think you're hopeless. He's still moving you towards the promised land, isn't he? So in Exodus 33:11, it says that the Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. That doesn't sound like somebody who's giving up. It doesn't sound like someone who's left. It sounds like a God who is very present and very engaged in what's happening right now with his people. And so I think Moses decides to capitalize on this friendship. You know, when you have a friend, you can speak very frankly to that friend. And so Moses says, in my words, hey, God, this was your plan. These are the people that you chose. Please don't stop showing the way. If I'm still your guide to lead them, please teach and show me what I'm supposed to do. This was your plan. And God responds to Moses and says, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. I love what the message says. It says, my presence will go with you. I'll see your journey to the end. Again, that doesn't sound like a God who's left the building. So Moses decides to just hammer this idea home and just clarify, make sure that he and God are on the same page. And he says, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? Oh, I feel like those are just words to hang on today as we try to wrap up this idea of renovate. God, if you don't go with us, if you don't lead the way, there's no reason to go. If you don't go with us, if you don't lead us, we won't look any different than anyone else. That's Moses speaking truth into our lives. If he doesn't go with us, if he doesn't lead the way, everything we try is in vain. If he doesn't go with us, if he doesn't lead the way, we won't have the ability to live the story that he has given us and share it with others. We won't look any different than anyone else around us. So, how do we do that? How do we let God lead the way? And a lot of times you hear me talking about, I love to give you an open-ended question to take and wrestle with. But today, I really feel like I have a couple of fill-in-the-blanks for you. A few places in our lives, in our culture, that probably touch all of us at some point. It's not the exhaustive list by any means. It's just two things that I feel like maybe we could see if God could lead a little better in those scenarios so that we don't trade the promise that God has before us of an abundant life with him in his presence. We don't trade that for something right in front of us that is immediate but will not fill us and will not give us the deeper purpose that he has for our lives. The first is technology. Technology is a tool. It's a good thing. I got a Shark robot vacuum for Christmas, and I love that thing. Because I can stand at the kitchen counter and do my little typing, which I would much rather do, and watch it clean my floors for me. But it's just a tool. And there is so much great technology in the world, but when we take something that is good and great and we make it what's best, we miss the point. And so I would challenge us with one idea today and some suggestions of where we might take care of that. And that is that we need to be intentional with our technology and intentionally without it. Intentional with it when it's active and being used in our lives. Intentionally without it. Sometimes. Intentional in how we comment and post opinions on social media. Is God's presence in what I am typing right now that somebody and possibly half the world will eventually read if it goes viral? Is God's presence in it? Is he leading it? Because if he's not, it won't tell his story and it might push someone away from his story. Is God's presence leading when we're being intentional about where we use technology? I, this week, and many times before, love sitting at my computer and getting things done. And my kitchen is my second office. And just this week, I really just felt God going, hey, shut down the second office. Your kids need something right now. You can do that later. I will not say that that's an easy thing for me. But it is definitely the challenge that is put in my life. I also think for our kids, we have to be intentional about technology. There is a study out of San Diego State that says that teenage and adolescent anxiety and depression has gone up in the last 5 or 6 years, directly correlating, they think, with the increased usage of smartphones. Now, it's not that smartphones are evil, okay? That's not what I'm saying. This is a tool. I have one, and I think just about everyone in this room probably has one. But it is not the place for our purpose and our value. And it's not the place where we find out if we are important or not, or if we matter or not. And we don't have to be tied to it like it's another appendage. Yet, that is a struggle with our adolescents. And if we could help them and guide them in that and build a life that they understand that their meaning comes from someplace else, and this is just a tool. Oh, I just feel like we would really, really help technology get back in its appropriate place. Even the PS4 and the Xbox in our living rooms, there's a study that's saying, listen, those combat video games, again, they're not the evil of the world, but an hour of that, of combat, in this really cool virtual reality can put a child in fight or flight mode for the next 24 hours. If they play it every day, that means they could possibly be in a constant state of fight or flight where they are irritable, having a hard time focusing, and anxious about life. Can we redeem technology so that it serves to help us take the presence of God with us instead of removing it from our lives? Maybe we could send a few more text prayers to people, celebrate someone on Facebook, and maybe, just a little suggestion, wait a little longer before we put that in the hands of our elementary children. And then when we do put it in their hands, we really need to train them and help them, because they will not understand what matters most if we don't tell them that this does not matter most. The second thing I think that we could really think about in our world is community. Now, nobody's surprised that Denise McKinney's talking about community, because first of all, it's part of my job here to help us create a space where people feel welcomed and that they belong. But I also just believe that that is the way God meant us to live. And I talk about it so much, I want you to hear someone else's opinion. Greg Thompson of the New City Commons has 6 practices of the church that he says we need to really live into. And one of them is community. And he basically says there's authentic community that really, really is what God wants for us. And then there are these parodies of community that feel like community, but in the end truly are not. One of them is individualistic community. Anybody feeling an oxymoron there? It's the kind of community where we all come together, but really the main priority, even if it's not, like, even if we don't consciously understand it, the main priority is for self. I am in this to get what I need to help myself, to build my life, whatever I can do. The I, me seems to be the common thread before the we. And then the second one is tribal community, which kind of sounds cool. But tribal community is actually saying, I am going to do community intentionally with people around me. But again, whether it's conscious or unconscious, tribal community tends to insulate us from people who are different from us. And so we don't learn how to venture out and live life with people who look differently, believe differently, have different traditions, have a different view of the world and politics. We feel more comfortable being with the one who can say, yes, I agree. But the person who sharpens our sword and helps us really understand God's heart is the one who shows us a different view that we have to wrestle with and think about. And so tribal community can also be a true hindrance to authentic community. So Dan Thompson says, let's combat these two issues of community with 2 responses. The first is schools of love. He says, you know what, let's just make every place in our world a classroom. Let's make the office, the school, the church, the small group, the friendship group, the gym, wherever you are, make it a school of love. Everywhere we find ourselves becomes the school of love for that moment, and we ask ourselves the question, how do I love these people? How can I love them? And of course, you know how dangerous it is to ask God that question, right? Because he will answer. How can I love these people? How can we be a church that is not tribal, that is not individualistic, by forming schools of love everywhere we go? The second thing he says that will combat these parodies of community is hospitality. Again, some of you are smiling going, does she always talk about hospitality? Yes, because I believe so strongly that when people feel welcomed, they experience the presence of God, sometimes for the first time, sometimes in a long time. It's been just a while, and they so much needed to know that it was okay to walk through the door of our church, of our home, into our lives. Hospitality is so crucial in the Christian community. But how about not what I say about it? Let's listen to what Greg Thompson has to say.
We have to reprioritize hospitality as the extension of love. Reprioritize hospitality as the extension of love, because the love that we have is not just for ourselves. This love that we grow, it's for our neighbors. And because of this, the work of the Christian church in this world is not the work of excluding our neighbors, but in embracing them through the work of hospitality. I want you to think about how powerful this is in this age. Think about your open door. Think about your warm welcome. Think about the holiness of pulling up that extra chair setting out that extra plate, filling that glass one more time, going and finding those linens and putting them on the bed. That is holy. That is holy. This is the work of hospitality. And I cannot imagine a more powerful protest against the tribal impulse of our own age than that. Welcoming those who are different than we are into our households and expressing love to them. And so we have to give ourselves to this work of hospitality. Because it's only as we do this that we can gather up the love that's extended to us by God and cultivated in us in our households and extend it to our neighbors.
Writing a story that he wants us to live into so that we can share it with others. In verse 18 of chapter 33, at the conclusion of this conversation with God, after God said, "Yes, Moses, yes to all your requests," Moses pretty much says, "Then show me your glory. I need to see and experience this presence of God. I need to see your glory." And in chapter 34, God does that. He says, "Okay, I'm going to pass by you. By the way, you're not going to be able to look straight on or it'll destroy you because I am so much more than you can handle with your own eyes. I am so much more than you can even imagine. So I'm going to cover part of your eyes, part of you, so that you won't be destroyed, but you will see my glory. I promise you." And in Acts 2, we read that scripture earlier. The new church saw his glory evidenced in their lives and how they saw God at work and people coming to faith in numbers every day. And then by Deuteronomy 1, they are up at the edge of the promised land. And once again, they're like, "Ah, I don't think we're going to make it. I don't think God can get us over there. Look, there's giants over there. We can't go over there. It's bad. It's dangerous. Let's not go." They are right back where they were at Mount Sinai, not trusting that God can get them there. And so the renovation must continue because God still has work to do with them. He's not finished. They've got a day, another day where like, "Oh, I'm not sure if he can come through for me." Ephesians 3:20 says, "Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us." Just hold on to that phrase, immeasurably more. Whatever you can measure, it's more. Whatever you can imagine, it's more. His love will get us there if we let him lead us. But we must allow him to take us there. And I just encourage you today to answer this open-ended question. Where is God's immeasurably more for you leading? Maybe it's in one of those areas that I already talked about, but I remember I told you that's not the exhaustive list. He may be just saying, "Oh, there's something else. There's another place in your life, another geography that you are not letting me lead you to the immeasurably more." What is the immeasurably more that God is leading you to? Henry Nouwen, one of my heroes, says, "Besides affirming life and remembering it, celebration is filled with expectations for the future. If the past has the last word, a man would imprison himself more and more the older he became. If the present were the ultimate moment of satisfaction, he would cling to it with hedonistic eagerness, trying to squeeze the last drop of life out of it. But the present holds promises and reaches out to the horizons of life, and this makes it possible for us to embrace our future as well as our past in the moment of celebration." So it's not a moment of, "Oh man, I failed again." It's a moment of celebration, of God saying, "My presence is here. Hi, I'd like to reintroduce myself to you again today. Can we get going on this renovation again? And I promise you, I am here and I will lead you." Hasn't given up on us. And so neither should we. Let's pray. God, if you don't go with us, if you don't lead the way, there's really no point. It will all be for naught. It won't have the purpose it needs. We will end up at a possible dead end. If you don't lead us, if you don't go with us, we will not be able to look different than the rest of the world and live into the story you have given us so that we can share it. So God, help us reimagine the relationship. Let us be willing and available for you to renovate and continue finishing us. In your name, amen.